in practice, fails to survive. Darwin recognized the problem because he added this proviso: provided always that speedy wolves retained strength to master their prey at this or at some other period of the year. But we can't just assume that only the wolf's speed is affected. Let's assume that a researcher in the field decides that a swift wolf will be selected for. After investigating the outcome, he finds that his theory is false. How does he react? Does he phone nature and say, "Hold the space, I have just falsified Darwin's natural selection"? Of course not. He concludes that some other factor was acting in that environment. "I don't know what it is right now," he might say, "but I'll keep looking." As Lewontin said, the failure to find the environmental factor proves nothing, except that one has not looked hard enough. In short, we can't simply say swiftness confers fitness, because maybe it does, and maybe it doesn't. It depends on reactions within that ever-changing thing called the environment. The problem is that the environment in which variations appear has literally thousands of components, and they can never be exhaustively specified or controlled for. In assuming that nothing else does change, Darwinians do their own controlled, that is, thought experiments, and see them through to a conclusion that is satisfying to them. The next day, Lewontin invited me to join him with some students on the lawn outside the Museum of Comparative Zoology. Here he made the basic point that a new adaptation won't be selected for unless it displays some relative advantage at the outset, which was Mivart's initial point about the eye. Later, Lewontin repeated the argument, and on the record in an interview with Lingua Franca. The journalist who wrote the article quoted Lewontin as saying, "We'd be better off flying. It would increase our fitness. We'd be better able to flee from predators. But if we flap our arms, we don't get any lift." He stands up and starts flapping his arms to illustrate. "Even if I picked up a pair of ping-pong paddles, it wouldn't help." He's walking around the room now, madly flapping his arms and still not getting any lift. "Until you're doing something, you're not doing it," Lewontin says by way of summary. And natural selection can't help. What natural selection does is to make more efficient what the organism is already doing. His argument was that natural selection alone can't explain the origin of flight, or of any complicated new function. Unless a small change gives an animal an advantage, the change won't be selected for, and obviously a little bit of a wing doesn't do any good. Lewontin's commitment to materialism is another aspect of his worldview that should be stressed. Consider the following comments in the New York Review of Books. They made a big impression at the time because they were so forthrightly expressed. "We take the side of science in spite of the patent absurdity of some of its constructs, in spite of its failure to fulfill many of its extravagant promises of health and life, in spite of the tolerance of the scientific community for unsubstantiated just-so stories, because we have a prior commitment, a commitment to materialism. It is not that the methods and institutions of science somehow compel us to accept a material explanation of the phenomenal world, but, on the contrary, that we are forced by our a priori adherence to material causes to create an apparatus of investigation and a set of concepts that produce material explanations, no matter how counterintuitive, no matter how mystifying to the uninitiated. Moreover, that materialism is absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. The eminent Kant scholar Louis Beck used to say that anyone who could believe in God could believe in anything. To appeal to an omnipotent deity is to allow that at any moment the regularities of nature may be ruptured, that miracles may happen. His point was that materialists don't believe in their philosophy because they are convinced by evolutionist claims. It is the other way around. They believe that the history of life can be explained by evolutionary processes because of their prior commitment to materialism. His argument can be restated this way. Complex, self-replicating organisms certainly exist. But in a purely material world, they can only arise by the slow accumulation of fortuitous changes, one after the other. So Darwinism, or something very similar to it, is close to being a deduction from a materialist premise. One who saw what was going on was Karl Marx. Writing to Engels in 1862, he said that for Darwin, the animal kingdom figures as civil society. It is remarkable how Darwin recognizes among the beasts and plants his English society with its division of labor, competition, opening up of new markets, invention, and the Malthusian struggle for existence. Marx admired Darwin, not of course for his economics, but for his materialism. Recommending The Origin to Ferdinand LaSalle, he wrote that despite all deficiencies, Darwin had for the first time dealt a death blow to teleology in the natural sciences. Darwinism forbids any reference to purpose or teleology, as it does to causes beyond the physical world. In fact, it seemed to make such causes redundant. In that sense, Darwin and Marx were comrades indeed. In the museum's elevator, no sign of E.O. Wilson coming down, and therefore no hushed silences, Lewontin asked me, out of the blue, why I thought sexual reproduction had appeared among living things. It had not occurred to me that that presented a problem for Darwinism. But years later, the biochemist Michael Behe told me that it does. In the Darwinian view, Behe said, the whole point of reproduction is to get your genes into the next generation. But with sexual reproduction, you only transmit half, the other half being contributed by your partner. So why does that happen? Nobody knows. Lewontin implied that he didn't know either. Lewontin's worldview encouraged him to take a critical look at natural selection, which Darwinians have almost always been reluctant to do. Today, in fact, some of those who might well agree with Lewontin about natural selection are likely to remain silent lest their unorthodoxy should attract reprisals within the academy. Lewontin had no such fears, and he made an impression on me and many others for that reason. But we need to look at a related issue. What is the modern scientific evidence that natural selection has really been observed? That is the subject of the next chapter. Chapter 6. What is the evidence for natural selection? In recent years, Darwin's theory of natural selection has been ever more extravagantly praised, even as counterarguments have increased. Daniel Dennett, the author of Darwin's Dangerous Idea, went further than most when he wrote, "If I were to give an award for the single best idea anyone has ever had, I'd give it to Darwin, ahead of Newton and Einstein and everyone else. In a single stroke, the idea of evolution by natural selection unifies the realm of life, meaning and purpose with the realm of space and time, cause and effect, mechanism, and physical law." An atheist, Dennett once said, "You'll never see a horseshoe making a blacksmith. You'll never see a pot making a potter." According to Richard Dawkins, however, natural selection provides a workable process that does that very counterintuitive thing. Dawkins and Dennett, both at Oxford at the same time, once worked as an unofficial team. The idea that a pot can make the potter is what made Darwin's contribution to human thought so revolutionary and so loaded with the power to raise consciousness, Dawkins wrote. The pot-to-potter claim is, in fact, quite helpful because it shows just how extreme, Dawkins says revolutionary, Darwin's idea was. It raised Dawkins' own consciousness. We can be excused if it fails to raise ours, at least until we hear some evidence for the claim. Elsewhere, Dawkins said that natural selection is the explanation for the existence and apparently purposeful form of all life. Furthermore, it is something that we know to be true. It is an automatic process. Julian Huxley, for one, was already on board. He said in 1959 that Darwin pointed out that no supernatural designer was needed, since natural selection could account for any known form of life. In The Origin of Species, Darwin provided one imaginary example of natural selection described in the previous chapter. Since then, a handful of examples have been endlessly recycled, and Darwin himself could well have mentioned them had he known what to look for. But they are not quite what he had in mind. He regarded natural selection as the mechanism that transforms one species into others. The modern examples show something far less impressive than that. So let's review them in turn and see what they show. The peppered moth. The most frequently cited example of natural selection is a change in the ratio of speckled and melanic dark moths in Britain. Ever since the Chicago Centennial, it has been promoted as providing the best support for Darwin's theory. In Chapter 3, I briefly covered the moths. Dark moths had spread in the industrial areas of Britain within living memory, said Professor E.B. Ford of Oxford. Julian Huxley added that the naturalist Bernard Kettlewell had shown that birds picked off a majority of those moths that did not match their surroundings. It was an actual quantitative experiment. Kettlewell began by collecting the two moth varieties and marking them for later recognition. Then he released them in two wooded areas, one polluted near Birmingham, the other in rural Dorset. In the polluted areas where trees were blackened, the dark moths were abundant. But in the rural woods, where lichens thrived on tree trunks, the light moths did best. The predators were sharp-eyed birds, so Kettlewell concluded that camouflage was the key to their differential survival. Kettlewell's experiment was later criticized because he released the moths during daylight hours and they fluttered to the nearest resting place, tree trunks. Later it was discovered that the moths do not rest there. Their normal resting place turned out to be high among the leaves in the crown of the trees. So there were complaints, even accusations of fraud. An amended version of the experiment was then done by a British biologist, Michael Madgerus, but he died before he could publish his results. Other biologists then came to his aid posthumously. His results, published in Biology Letters, weakly supported the bird predation and camouflage theory. Jonathan Wells included a chapter on these much-studied moths in his book Icons of Evolution. He reviewed Kettlewell's data, but in a sense it was all irrelevant. As Wells later wrote, Darwinian evolution requires much more than the selection of beneficial traits, and much more than a shift in the proportions of light and dark-colored moths. It requires the descent with modification of all living things from one or a few common ancestors. Darwin did not write a book titled, How the Proportions of Two Pre-Existing Moth Varieties Can Change Through Natural Selection. He wrote a book titled, On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection. The real question, Wells added, is whether natural selection can produce new species, organs, and body plans. That is not answered, or even addressed by shifts in the proportions of pre-existing varieties of the same species. Madgerus said in a 2007 lecture that the moth story is important because it is one of the most visually impacting and easily understood examples of Darwinian evolution in action. Therefore, it should be taught. It provides, after all, the proof of evolution. Wells commented, "What matters evidently is that the moth story is a useful tool for indoctrinating students in Darwinian evolution." Jerry Coyne, the author of Why Evolution is True, and an early critic of the Kettlewell deception, embraced the Madgerus revision. "I am delighted to agree with this conclusion, which answers my previous criticisms about the Biston story," he wrote. Biston betularia is the Latin name of the moth species. Coyne then continued, "But we have to remember that the evidence for natural selection never rested entirely, or even substantially, on the bird predation experiments, but rather on the data sets documenting allele frequency changes that were consistent, parallel on two continents, and then reversed when the environment changed." Coyne's last seven words are significant. After Britain enacted its Clear Air Act, the polluted woods recovered, and the dark moths lost their relative advantage. The ratio of dark and speckled moths, allele frequency changes, then reverted to normal. In the unpolluted environment, the light-colored moths regained the adaptive title. It is sometimes said that natural selection caused the moths to adapt to their environment. but notice that no individual moth changed color or acquired a novel adaptation. The dark and light varieties existed before the experiment began and were still with us after pollution controls were in place. The dark, melanic variety simply became relatively more numerous. It might be said that the moth population adapted, but that only serves to disguise the point that individual moths did not. The persistent invocation of the moth experiment, despite its obvious weakness, shows that evolutionists do not have more persuasive examples to offer. Resistance to antibiotics. As a popular example of natural selection, bacterial resistance to antibiotics is a close runner-up to the moths. So let's hear the drumroll from Richard Dawkins. Bacterial resistance illustrates the wondrous power of natural selection. What is that wondrous power? Bacteria are single-celled organisms found all over the world, in our gut, E. coli, and deep underwater. Some can replicate asexually in a matter of minutes, and their short generation span accounts for their popularity among lab researchers. If Silicon Valley were ever to achieve self-replication, it would indeed demonstrate a wondrous power. But it is something that engineers have not yet been able to manage with any artifact designed by humans. Bacteria subsist on a wide variety of nutrients drawn from their environment. Now add a poison to the mix. For example, an antibacterial substance such as penicillin, discovered by Alexander Fleming in 1928. What happens? Some or many of the bacteria will die, but others will survive the onslaught. The number of bacteria species is not known, but it is thought to be in the millions. Some may well be immune to the poison, and so they will survive. The ones that do survive, the fittest, of course, will have greater access to nutrients. They will flourish. So that is what bacterial resistance to antibiotics amounts to. Differential survival. Once again, some bacteria flourish, others don't. But this does not explain how any bacterium was generated in the first place. As with the moths, then, bacterial resistance to antibiotics explains how we get more of something that already exists. Now let's complicate the picture a little with help from Michael Behe, the biochemist at Lehigh University. In Darwin's Black Box, 1996, he famously drew attention to the irreducible complexity of the bacterial flagellum, an outboard propeller that transports bacteria through fluids. Behe's message was that if you try to build the flagellum one part at a time, it won't function. All the parts need to be in place from the beginning. In that respect, it is like a mousetrap, Behe said. Part of a mousetrap placed on the floor won't catch a few mice. It won't catch any. In a recent interview, I asked Behe if any new features of an organism have been shown to arise by natural selection. As far as I know, the strongest such evidence comes from antibiotic resistance in bacteria, he told me. But what about the argument that it gives you more of what you already have? That is usually true, Behe replied, but an experiment can begin with just one bacterium, and that sometimes does show something new. He reassured me that you can indeed start an experiment with a single bacterium, and one that has no resistance to antibiotics. You can grow that up, and as they grow into large numbers, mistakes in the DNA are made, comparable to errors in a manuscript that is repeatedly copied. But what you find, Behe added, is that most of these mutations involve the loss of an activity or function that the bacterium once had. In such cases, some of those mutations might luckily help it survive in the presence of an antibiotic, or something else in the environment, Behe said. In that way, a mutated bacterium develops antibiotic resistance even though its progenitor was unprotected. But it also shows something else. It is good evidence that mutations can do little more than break things, Behe went on, and occasionally those breaks have a beneficial side effect. But it certainly isn't building anything. We shall hear a similar story from Behe in Chapter 16, dealing with Richard Lenski's multi-generational experiment at Michigan State University. Lenski has bred bacteria nonstop in his lab since 1988 and is continuing to do so. Again, he showed that when a mutation breaks a bacterial bond, it can be as liberating to bacteria as it is to a prisoner who breaks his chains. Nonetheless, Lenski's bacteria remain the same species of bacteria to this day. According to Lee Spentner, all cases of antibiotic resistance in bacteria involve such breaking, which is a loss of information in the genome. When the antibiotic is removed from the bacterial environment, the bacteria revert to their natural form, which is more robust. Losing information is not the kind of evolution that leads to greater complexity and new structures. The main point is that experimental evidence on antibiotic resistance has not shown us how we get bacteria or any other microbe. All it has shown is how we get relatively more or fewer of one variety or another. Meanwhile, something else has come up. If you search online for antibiotic resistance, you will find it presented not as a triumph of Darwinism, but as a problem for public health. This is from the Center for Disease Control. Almost every type of bacteria has become stronger and less responsive to antibiotic treatment when it is really needed. These antibiotic-resistant bacteria can quickly spread to family members, schoolmates, and co-workers, threatening the community with a new strain of infectious disease that is more difficult to cure and more expensive to treat. Galapagos finches. In the 1980s, we began to hear that finches in the Galapagos Islands provide one more example of natural selection. This is our third illustration. Darwin spent a few weeks there in 1835 when on board HMS Beagle. He brought finch specimens home to England, but he was not much interested in them at the time. Over 100 years later, the ornithologist David Lack published Darwin's Finches, 1947, proposing that different beak sizes on the different islands were adaptations caused by natural selection. According to Lack, the finches started a train of thought which culminated in the origin of species. But Darwin's involvement in this story is less important than what happened later. The key Galapagos research done by Peter and Rosemary Grant, starting in 1973, was described in detail by Jonathan Weiner in The Beak of the Finch, 1994. He called the Grant's work the best and most detailed demonstration to date of the power of Darwin's process. The Galapagos finches are distinguished mainly by the size of their beaks. A key event was a drought in 1977, when rainfall was a fraction of normal. The finches eat seeds, and with the drought, small seeds became scarce. To crack open the more abundant large seeds, a larger beak helped. Natural selection, therefore, favored the finches with larger beaks. It was a selection event, said the Grants. They concluded that only about 20 such events would be needed to transform an average Galapagos finch into an entirely different species. Here the Grants were extrapolating, and as Jonathan Wells said, their extrapolation depended on the assumption that increases in beak size are cumulative from one drought to the next. A few years later, the El Niño current brought heavy rainfall, and small seeds were once again abundant. The average beak size then returned to its previous level. In 1987, Peter Grant and his graduate student duly reported in Nature a reversal in the direction of selection. Smaller beak size was favored in years following very wet conditions, possibly because the food supply is dominated by small, soft seeds. Selection had flipped, wrote Jonathan Weiner. The birds took a giant step backward after their giant step forward. The finch population was oscillating back and forth. Wells concluded in Icons of Evolution, thanks to years of careful research by the Grants and their colleagues, we know quite a lot about natural selection and breeding patterns in Darwin's finches. And the available evidence is clear. First, selection oscillates with climatic fluctuations and does not exhibit long-term evolutionary change. Yet evidence for oscillating natural selection in finchbeaks is claimed as evidence for the origin of finches in the first place. In Why Evolution is True, Jerry Coyne picked up the story, or a part of it. He attributed the finch's adaptation to an anomalous change in the climate. The large-beaked survivors left more offspring, and then, by the next generation, natural selection had increased the average beak size by 10%. Body size increased as well. That is a staggering rate of evolutionary change, far larger than anything we see in the fossil record. Everything we require of evolution by natural selection was amply documented by the Grants in other studies. But there was one thing Coyne didn't tell his readers, that when the rains returned with El Niño, the average beak size returned to normal. Darwin might well have been dismayed if the meager evidence for natural selection, assembled over many years, had been presented to him 150 years after The Origin was published. A change in the ratio of pre-existing varieties? That is all you have been able to come up with? He might reasonably have asked. It is worth bearing in mind how feeble this evidence is any time someone tells you that Darwinism is a fact. Armchair Philosophy. In an article he wrote for the journal Evolution, Richard Dawkins commented on the astronomer Fred Hoyle's claim that natural selection is as likely to build organic life as a tornado blowing through a junkyard is to create a Boeing 747. Dawkins said Hoyle didn't seem to realize that in Darwin's theory, selection is cumulative. Small gains are saved. The hurricane doesn't spontaneously assemble the airliner in one go. Small improvements are added bit by bit. Adaptive evolution must be gradual and cumulative, Dawkins continued, because nothing except gradual accumulation could, in principle, do the job of solving the 747 riddle. Thus, the evolution of the vertebrate eye must have been progressive. Ancient ancestors had a very simple eye, and we don't need evidence for this, although it is nice that it is there. It has to be true because the alternative, an initially complex eye, well endowed with features good for seeing, pitches us right back to Hoyle country and the sheer cliff of improbability. There must be a ramp of step-by-step progress toward the modern, multi-featured descendant of that optical prototype. Dawkins added that modern analogs of every step up the ramp can be found, working serviceably, in dozens of eyes dotted independently around the animal kingdom. But even without them, we could be confident that there must have been a gradual progressive increase. Without stirring from our armchair, we can see that it must be so. Dawkins's underlying method is revealed by his repeated assertions that something must be, must have been, had to be true. What this shows is that his science is subordinate to his philosophy. Since, in his view, evolution is true, and since complex organs like eyes certainly exist, it follows that they must have been accumulated bit by bit. Darwinism itself obliges us to believe that. We don't even have to study the evidence. Dawkins's armchair philosophy tells him what must be true before he is under the obligation to observe anything. Dawkins does claim that evidence shows us dozens of eyes working serviceably and dotted independently around the animal kingdom. But as we saw in the previous chapter, and as Darwin recognized, they do not even remotely form a parent-offspring chain. That is why Dawkins inserted the word independently. In the same way, the six words, "Methinks it is like a weasel," can be found dotted independently around any library, but that does not mean that someone else was independently on his way to writing Hamlet. Let us give the last word to the Columbia University geneticist Thomas Hunt Morgan, 1866 to 1945, who almost 100 years ago was skeptical of the claims being made about natural selection. He won the Nobel Prize in 1933. In his Drosophila experiments, he kept on attempting to increase the number of bristles in fruit flies, but the number would always reach a plateau which could not be exceeded. He then commented, and perhaps this should be engraved in stone, "Selection, then, has not produced anything new, but only more of certain kinds of individuals. Evolution, however, means producing new things, not more of what already exists. That is all that modern researchers have been able to show in our day, too. And it raises a further question. The Finch observations on the Galapagos showed oscillations about a mean. They did not confirm what Alfred R. Wallace in 1858 called indefinite departure from the original type. In fact, they tended to disconfirm it. Which leads to the important question, has any researcher ever been able to show such indefinite departure from the original type? If not, what reason do we have for accepting that Darwin's theory is true? Meanwhile, natural selection is perpetually affirmed by proponents as the mechanism built into nature that can account for whatever is observed to exist. Its details do not have to be observed. Whatever exists, natural selection explains it. Darwin continues to be the hero of materialism because he discovered an unguided mechanism that can be brought on stage to explain everything that exists in biology without having to resort to the supernatural. So far, however, there is no evidence to show that this process is actually responsible for the fantastically diverse array of species that populate our world. Natural selection functions in the realm of philosophy, not science. Chapter 7. On Extinction. The claim that evolution is a fact often rests on the assumption that evolution means change over time. As no one doubts that change over time is a reality, it's an easy case to make. But by evolution, we understand something much more precise than that. Extinction, on the other hand, is a fact any way you look at it. Dinosaurs make the case quite effectively. So what does extinction tell us about evolution and about our own times? By one estimate, 99.9% of all species that ever lived are now extinct. If so, we might reasonably assume that, just as we all are destined to die, so all species are destined to go extinct. The most famous modern example is that of the passenger pigeon. Martha, the last living specimen, died at the Cincinnati Zoo in 1914. The last known Tasmanian wolf died in the Hobart Zoo in 1936. There are said to have been 5 mass extinctions, very roughly at 100 million year intervals. The 5th is thought to have been caused by a meteorite, about 65 million years ago, killing off the dinosaurs. But no one is sure where it landed or whether it really caused their extinction. A large underwater crater in the Yucatan is the current favorite. Others now suggest that climate change may have been the villain. There have also been numerous background extinctions, which seem to be continuous. Some say that background and mass extinctions blend into one another. Many paleontologists and commentators think that we are now experiencing the 6th and worst mass extinction, the one caused by human beings. Anyone searching the subject online today will find that extinction of the old-fashioned kind has almost been submerged by the supposedly high current rate of extinction, a rate attributed to human carelessness and indifference. Leading the list of indictments has been the destruction of habitat, the loss of biodiversity, and global warming. I shall have something to say about these issues, best thought of as political, later in this chapter. Meanwhile, what caused all those earlier extinctions, whether mass or background? Darwin discussed the issue at some length in The Origin of Species. Extinction, he argued, is intimately connected with natural selection, his all-explanatory mechanism. Selection preserved favored forms, a truism, which duly survived. But he further claimed that most geographical areas are already fully stocked with inhabitants, from which it followed that as the favored forms increase in number, so generally will the less favored decrease and become rare. Rarity, as geology tells us, is the precursor to extinction. Darwin conceded, correctly, that we don't have any way of knowing that any given region really is fully stocked with species. but that also meant there was no way of testing his theory. Later, he repeated his extinction argument in a slightly different form. Each new form will tend in a fully stocked country to take the place of and finally to exterminate its own less improved parent or other less favored forms with which it comes into competition. Thus, extinction and natural selection will, as we have seen, go hand in hand. The alternative was to believe that the number of specific forms goes on perpetually and almost indefinitely increasing. But he believed that no such increase had been observed, as geology shows us plainly. Indeed, he added, we can see why the number of species should not have increased, for the number of places in the polity of nature is not indefinitely great. Darwin's argument can be analogized to a building with a flat roof and no side barriers. As new people, better adapted ones, keep coming up an escalator into the limited space on top, others, already on the roof and less well adapted, get pushed off and fall to their deaths. Such is the philosophy of progress that animated Darwin and his contemporaries. Well-adapted organisms kept on replacing less well-adapted ones. The fit are replaced by the fitter, and the fittest inevitably survive. And so life keeps right on improving. It hardly needs saying that such a philosophy has been overthrown in our own day. In the Western world, humans are widely seen as the villains of creation, an ongoing threat to many other life forms. It follows for the idea's proponents that our numbers should, ideally, be reduced or at least minimized. Alan Weisman's book, The World Without Us, in which humans have disappeared without explanation, became a surprise bestseller in 2007. Weisman called his book a fantasy, but it was widely seen as an optimistic one. Darwin resumed his discussion of extinction later on in The Origin. This time he compared the philosophies of uniformitarianism and catastrophism. The biblical flood was the primeval catastrophe, but by Darwin's day it was already seen as a myth. Enlightenment ideas were fast replacing biblical ones. The old notion was that the Earth's inhabitants had been swept away by catastrophes, Darwin wrote, but that view was being abandoned even by those geologists, and here he named three, whose general views would naturally lead them to this conclusion. Darwin thought the study of tertiary formations gave us good reason to accept a more uniformitarian philosophy in which species gradually disappeared, one after another, first from one spot, then from another, and finally from the world. Tertiary refers to the geologic period from 66 million to about 2.5 million years ago. Throughout the 19th century, the philosophy of gradualism replaced catastrophism, with Darwin's The Origin greatly contributing to the new worldview. Oddly enough, physical evidence for past global catastrophes has accumulated in recent years, leading to a revival of interest in catastrophism. In the uniformitarian, or gradualist, view, supported by the geologist Charles Lyell and then by Darwin, physical causes acting now are assumed to be the same as those that acted in the past. Therefore, the present is a reliable guide to the past. Modern science itself was partly an offspring of the uniformitarian worldview. Predictions, for example, can only really be tested in an environment that is roughly unchanging, and so predictable. Catastrophism, in contrast, introduces unforeseen events. Abrupt novelties, such as meteorites plunging into the Earth and, maybe, wiping out the dinosaurs, could happen at any time. In the modern polity of nations, to use Darwin's phrase, revolutions are often admired, at least by those on the political left. To them, parliaments are old-fashioned affairs, and the rule of law, with its slow, incremental changes, is a little on the dull side, perhaps too predictable. Stephen Jay Gould, who was partly responsible for the renewed popularity of catastrophism, wrote in his introduction to David M. Raup's book, Extinction, Bad Genes or Bad Luck, 1991. The extraterrestrial theory of mass extinction easy to conceptualize but purposed with good supporting data for the first time only in 1980, may revolutionize not only our view of life's history, but our entire concept of historical change by making illegitimate catastrophism respectable again. So again, what caused all those earlier extinctions? In Darwin Retried, my old friend Norman Macbeth quoted Gavin De Beer as saying that it remains unclear why any given species has disappeared. De Beer was director of London's Natural History Museum and president of the Linnean Society in the 1950s. Macbeth also saw that extinction's difficulty parallels the one besetting natural selection. It is all too easy to say that a species becomes extinct because it failed to adapt, while establishing its failure to adapt only by its becoming extinct. The Harvard evolutionist Ernst Mayr did say something close to that. In 1963, he claimed that extinction was due to the inability of animals to respond to new selection pressures. Then he added, "The actual cause of the extinction of any fossil species will presumably always remain uncertain." George Gaylord Simpson said much the same thing. Particular cases of extinction, other than those evidently due to competition, are usually hard or impossible to explain in detail. The basic problem was that there are too many possibilities to choose from, just as there often are with establishing the cause of an individual death in the absence of a pathologist. In 2013, Charles Marshall of UC Berkeley's Museum of Paleontology offered the failure to evolve in relation to the environment as a cause of extinction. A decrease in the origin of new species seemed to be driving some mammals to extinction, he thought. Notice that Darwin saw an increase in speciation as a driver of extinction. For Charles Marshall, a decline has the same effect. Raup's Caveats. Perhaps the most open-minded book on the subject today is the late David M. Raup's 1991 work, Extinction, Bad Genes or Bad Luck? A paleontologist at the University of Chicago and a member of the National Academy of Sciences, he also wrote The Nemesis Affair, The Story of the Death of Dinosaurs and the Waves of Science, 1986. His extinction book includes the following passage, echoing De Beer, Mayr, and Simpson. The disturbing reality is that for none of the thousands of well-documented extinctions in the geologic past do we have a solid explanation of why the extinction occurred. We have many proposals in specific cases, of course. Trilobites died out because of competition from newly evolved fish. Dinosaurs were too big or stupid. The antlers of Irish elk became too cumbersome. They are all plausible scenarios, but no matter how plausible, they cannot be shown to be true beyond reasonable doubt. Equally plausible alternative scenarios can be invented with ease, and none has predictive power in the sense that it can be shown a priori that a given species or anatomical type was destined to go extinct. Sadly, the only evidence for the inferiority of victims of extinction is the fact of their extinction. A circular argument. The weakness of the argument does not, of course, invalidate the notion that extinction is based on fitness. It may only reflect our ignorance. For example, mammals of the late Cretaceous may have actually been better adapted than the dinosaurs, but our knowledge of these animals may not be good enough for us to recognize that superiority. Raup's comment about extinctions is a mirror image of Darwin's about speciation. Just as in no case do we have a solid explanation of why the extinction occurred, so in no case does Darwin give us a solid explanation of why speciation occurred. David Raup, 1933-2015, was refreshingly non-dogmatic, frequently offering alternative ways of looking at the evidence. Extinction is a difficult research topic, he allowed. He thought that there might be 40 million species alive today, and that 1,000 times that number were extinct. Species are temporary phenomena. An average duration of 10 million years for a particular species is unusually long. Yet even that is only a small fraction, 0.25%, of the duration of life on Earth. His outlook is sometimes Darwinian, as when he accepts that some disappearances are what he calls pseudo-extinctions. One species may disappear by transforming itself into another. Yet he also accepts that true extinction is real and prevalent. But he also challenged Darwin as when he questioned the importance of competition. For Darwin, whose master was Malthus, competition was the beating heart of natural selection. Raup allowed that evolutionary biologists have long emphasized competition, but more recently, ecologists have downplayed its role. Competition, Raup thought, may not be as crucial as once thought, especially in extinction. In Darwin's view, it was the force of competition that kept driving new productions onward and upward in a progressive direction. We have heard of living fossils, such as sharks, horseshoe crabs, the ginkgo tree, and the coelacanth, which seems to have endured forever, but in none of those cases is the living species the same as the fossil species. In detail, the Jurassic types of shark and horseshoe crabs are not to be confused with those living today. Raup also discussed the amazing flying reptiles known as pterosaurs, which lived from about 200 million years ago to the Cretaceous-Tertiary extinction, the one thought to have been caused by a meteorite. One of the pterosaurs was larger than many airplanes. Its wings had no feathers, but were formed of large folds or extensions of skin suspended from greatly lengthened bones of fingers, somewhat like the wings of modern bats. Furthermore, pterosaurs were capable of taking off from level ground and of powered flight, yet they left no descendants. Faced with such marvels, an agnostic Raup seemed to be saying, "Who knows how all these things happened?" Pterosaurs were merely another successful group that appeared, flourished for a time, then disappeared. Lest I give the impression of the pterosaur interval as being short-lived, note that their time on Earth was 30 times longer than ours so far. Like Darwin, Raup believed that extinction encouraged evolution. The fossil record shows that many adaptive breakthroughs, bursts of speciation, accompanied by the origin of new families and orders, occur after the big mass extinctions. Perhaps another way of looking at the matter is to suggest that the history of life on Earth is analogous to a six-act play, with the five great extinctions ringing down the curtain at the close of each act. Humans appear only toward the end, in the last act. Meanwhile, bacteria seem to be an exception to the theory that extinction drives evolution. Visible in the pre-Cambrian period, bacteria do not appear to have changed much during their long tenure on Earth, Raup said. They are difficult to kill, and many of the earliest bacteria are indistinguishable in shape and structure from their living counterparts. As a side note, Karl Popper called bacteria immortal. When a bacterium divides, where is the individual that preceded the division? If one of those new bacteria dies, is that any different from the death of a skin cell? In other words, the entire population of a bacterial species may be compared to a single individual. Raup was a strong supporter of the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Only by discovering life elsewhere in space will we really have the means to know whether our own biological system has predictable patterns not yet recognized. No extraterrestrial life has yet been found, of course. He noted that sea level, whether high or low, may have been associated with extinction, and that the level at present is somewhat lower than it was during most times in the past. Raup was not among today's climate change alarmists. While temperature fluctuations are large, he wrote, the overall trend as the present day is approached is one of cooling. That was written in 1990, so maybe the Earth has warmed up a little since then. The Sixth Great Extinction. The leading proponents of the claim that humans are causing the Sixth Great Extinction have been former Vice President Al Gore and Harvard Emeritus Professor E. O. Wilson. In 2014, Wilson visited England for a symbolic groundbreaking of the Mass Extinction Memorial Observatory to be built in Dorset, the country where we found an abundance of those speckled moths. On this occasion, in a BBC interview, Wilson dismissed Richard Dawkins as a mere journalist. The Memorial Observatory is on the World Heritage Jurassic Coast. Why had not one heard of that? And it will highlight 17,000 species under threat worldwide. It will also function as an information and exhibition center dedicated to the 860 species of animals, birds, insects, and sea life that have been identified as extinct since the demise of the dodo in the 17th century. Notice the big disparity between the number of threatened and identified extinctions, the former 20 times greater than the latter. If there have been 860 known extinctions since the time of Dodo, approximately 1650 AD, that would be close to two species a year possibly attributable to human action. Is that figure shockingly large? Estimates of the number of species alive today range from 8.7 million to 1 trillion. It is generally thought that perhaps as much as 99% of the species that ever lived are now extinct. Even at the low end of the current inventory, that would mean that nature has done away with far more species than the human race has. Denise O'Leary, the editor of a website called Uncommon Descent, considers that a real possibility. But it all depends on your point of view. She gave the example of the black bear, which has been doing well in the Canadian province of Ontario. Bears can live off stuff humans throw out. So can raccoons, skunks, etc. Deer like horticultural gardens just fine. Many people feed wild birds, squirrels, chipmunks, rabbits. In Toronto, where I lived for nearly 50 years, thousands of Canada geese no longer migrate as people feed them, and they can gobble lawns in milder winter weather. Agriculture has not hurt the woodchuck or the grasshopper one bit. Human prosperity has not hurt wildlife here, if you go by the hugely increased premium food supply humans create. But that's just me. Maybe if I lived in the rainforest, I would see something different. In an interview at Harvard, Wilson recently gave a more global account, showing the high degree of uncertainty. We are on a little-known planet. We have knowledge of 2 million species, but for the vast majority, we know only the name and a little bit of the anatomy. We don't know anything at all about their biology. There are conservatively at least 8 million species in all, and it's probably much more than that because of the bacteria and archaea and microorganisms we're just beginning to explore. The number of species remaining to be discovered could easily go into the tens of millions. Well, is it 8 million or tens of millions? No matter. The great drive to indict the human race seems unstoppable, reflecting the huge loss of self-confidence that overcame Western elites in the latter part of the 20th century. It is a development that would have amazed Darwin himself. A Washington Post review of Wilson's latest book, The Meaning of Human Existence, was headlined, "Is Earth's Dominant Species Doomed to Self-Destruct?" In recent years, exaggerated concern about human activity has become the norm. In 1980, the Global 2000 report predicted that 15 to 20% of all species would become extinct by the year 2000. In 1993, Aaron Wildavsky and Julian Simon concluded that those numbers were based on pure guesswork. More recently, Wilson updated that, saying it is entirely possible that we will lose half the world species by the end of the 21st century. A British newspaper reported that for the first time since the dinosaurs disappeared, humans are driving animals and plants to extinction faster than new species can evolve. One might add that no subject is more susceptible to influence by fashionable opinion than claims about extinction. The crisis is driven by hunting, the spread of alien predators, and disease and climate change, according to the newspaper report. The Center for Biological Diversity said in 2010 that although extinction is a natural phenomenon occurring at a background rate of about 1 to 5 species per year, scientists estimate we're now losing species at 1,000 to 10,000 times the background rate, with literally dozens going extinct every day. The center added that as many as 30 to 50% of all species could be heading for extinction by mid-century. Maybe in the end, we shouldn't take either these extinction numbers or their explanation too seriously. Natural selection is enlisted to explain either the origin of a species or its extinction. Did the organism flourish? That's natural selection for you. Did it die out? That's the failure of natural selection. First it got the job done, but then it put the organism in a fix with no solution. We should be every bit as skeptical about extinction rates as of claims about natural selection. Chapter 8. Is variation indefinite or limited? Wallace's ternate essay was sent to Darwin in 1858 and titled, On the Tendency of Varieties to Depart Indefinitely from the Original Type. It was published by the Linnean Society along with Darwin's own contributions. At the end of his essay, Wallace wrote, We believe we have now shown that there is a tendency in nature to the continued progression of certain classes of varieties further and further from the original type, a progression to which there appears no reason to assign any definite limits. Wallace's title clarifies what evolutionists must show today. Small, heritable changes that keep on accumulating. Making a similar case, Darwin accepted indefinite departure as true. In his 1844 essay, he argued that a limit to variation does exist in nature is assumed by most authors, but he was unable to discover a single fact on which this belief is grounded. But Darwin himself failed to provide a single fact to overturn what most authors had accepted. He would certainly have done so had he known of any. The birds his pigeon fancier friends bred always remained pigeons, and he was well aware of that. Neither Wallace nor Darwin ever observed indefinite departure, and both knew of the counterclaims against it. Nonetheless, most biologists and all Darwinians since then have regarded indefinite departure from the original type as a given, without so much as asking whether it has been demonstrated experimentally. So the question arises, has it ever been demonstrated? If not, there may be no scientific reason to accept Darwinism as a fact. Philosophical arguments in favor of an uninterrupted parent-offspring change since the origin of life may be quoted, but the key evidence would still be missing. It is usual at this point to make a distinction between microevolution and macroevolution, and to add that microevolution is obviously true. You differ from your parents, and you may do so in a thousand ways. We all differ from each other in small ways. Therefore, the argument goes, microevolution is a fact. But it is misleading, surely, to identify small individual differences as evolutionary, even if only in a micro way. Variations between generations were known to us long before Darwin, without ever being regarded as small steps in the direction of something completely new, incipient speciation, for example. They are a fact of life, not evolution in miniature. Darwin, nonetheless, assumed that small changes do accumulate. It was central to his theory, virtually a restatement of it. It was based on extrapolation from the small variations that we see every day, and which animal breeders can, to a small extent, magnify. But was this extrapolation justified? A number of observations on this topic have been made over the years. A brief summary follows. First, consider Thomas Robert Malthus, 1766 to 1834. He died 25 years before The Origin of Species was written, but his famous Malthusian theory strongly influenced Darwin. Nonetheless, Malthus preemptively rejected indefinite departure. In the following, Malthus used the word improvement instead of evolution, a word that was still not in general use. In his essay on the principle of population, Malthus wrote, One of the most obvious features of the improvement is the increase of size. The flower has grown gradually larger by cultivation. If the progress were really unlimited, it might be increased ad infinitum. But this is so gross an absurdity that we may be quite sure that among plants, as well as among animals, there is a limit to improvement, though we do not exactly know where it is. Francis Galton, 1822-1911, Darwin's half-cousin, they shared a common grandparent, was an early eugenicist and statistician. He published Regression Towards Mediocrity in Hereditary Stature in 1886. Characteristics, for example height, in parents are not passed on completely to their offspring, he wrote.